All right, tonight we start going into the subject of money. And what I want to do to introduce the subject is to indicate its enormous importance, the existence of money. Thank you. Without exaggeration, our whole modern civilization, our way of life, indeed our very survival, depends on the existence of money as an economic phenomenon. We all know how important money is to each of us individually. What I'm out to show now is that there is really no good way of conducting an economic system without the use of money. What depends on money, the link between the importance of money and our lives and well-being, is the division of labor and the fact that we all live as specialists. Each of us devotes pretty much his full working time to producing or helping to produce just one or at most a very small number of things, which are overwhelmingly and in many cases entirely consumed by other people. And at the same time, what each of us consumes is produced overwhelmingly or entirely by other people. Just think of how each of you spends his working day. I doubt that any two of you are doing exactly the same work. Even if you work at the same company, you probably have somewhat different job descriptions. Each of us works as a specialist, and each of us applied by a vast host of other people. Things have not always been this way. In fact, most of the world's population, even today, lives in a very different way. They devote the far greater part of their labor to producing for their own and their own families immediate consumption. So a farmer in rural China or rural India and many other places in the world devotes the far greater part of his time, the great majority of it, to growing food and producing other necessities for himself and his family, and only very minimally is producing for the market, and only very minimally is supplied from the market, and therefore from the labor of other people. The fact that we do specialize and apply our labor, each of us, to the production of just one or a few things, this permits an enormous increase in the amount of knowledge that enters into the productive process. Each specialization has its own unique body of knowledge. In contrast, a society of self-sufficient farmers is essentially just one body of knowledge, a body of knowledge to be a self-sufficient farmer. And that body of knowledge is duplicated by all the millions and tens of millions of people living in the same way. But here, in a division of labor society, we have as many different bodies of knowledge entering into the productive process as there are specialized occupations. And each of us benefits pretty much from the totality of all this knowledge in our capacity as a consumer. When you buy anything, you are implicitly and indirectly getting the benefit of all of the knowledge pertaining to production that entered into the products that you're buying. So when you buy an automobile, you're getting the benefit of the knowledge of the people in the auto plants, the people in the steel mills that supply the auto plants, the people in the iron mines, etc., etc. And, of course, the benefit of all of the engineering feats and the scientific discoveries that preceded the engineering advances. You're getting all that when you buy an automobile, and similarly for each and everything else. So each of us is the beneficiary of an enormous quantity of knowledge, and the fact that we use so much knowledge in production makes it possible to produce products that would otherwise be impossible. If the body of knowledge was limited to what one farmer and his wife could hold or one farmer and his wife plus a few neighboring villagers, it would be unthinkable to attempt to produce such a thing as a jet engine or any complex product. And virtually all machinery comes under the heading of complex products. There is no one who holds all of the knowledge required to produce such a simple thing as a ballpoint pen, let alone a lathe or a cotton weaving machinery or whatever. Machines and complex products in general are possible only when there's this broad body of knowledge in a division of labor society, and also access to an enormous range of raw materials, which is another aspect of the division of labor. In a division of labor society, each geographical region concentrates on whatever advantages it possesses, or largely concentrates on its advantages in the way of minerals or special climate conditions for growing different crops. So in that part of the state of Minnesota, where the Wasabi Range exists, which is immensely rich in iron ore, there is a significant concentration on the production of iron ore. They're producing far more iron ore than is locally required, and the rest of the country and much of the rest of the world gets the benefit of that iron ore. And similarly, people in oil-producing regions are producing far beyond their own consumption, and broad areas get the benefit of that. And to make machines or any other complex product, you generally need access to a considerable range of materials. And that's an aspect of the division of labor, too. And then, without going much further into the subject, there's a major dynamic element in the division of labor society, and that is that a substantial proportion of the most intelligent, most ambitious members of such a society concentrate on specializations concerned with the acquisition and application of new knowledge. These are the specializations in the various branches of science, engineering, and also, very importantly, business. A major aspect of business activity is the seeking out and the actual instigation of engineering and often scientific advances that will make possible the production of new or more efficiently produced products. Now, none of this would be possible to any great extent in the absence of the existence of money. If we would not have the existence of money, we would have minimal division of labor. Just think as to why this would be the case. Suppose we didn't have money, and money, I should point out right away, is a good, a leading or essential characteristic of which is that practically everybody in a given area is eager to accept it in exchange for whatever it is that he himself produces. Money is the one thing that everyone in a society is eager to accept in exchange for his own goods or services. Some people want Dell computers, others want Chevrolet automobiles, but not everybody wants either of these items, certainly not very often, but everybody does want money pretty much all the time. And this means that once you come into the possession of money, if it is something that everyone does want, then it's a simple matter for you to turn around and obtain whatever it is you want. Because of money, life is greatly simplified in that all you have to do to get whatever it is you want from other people is to find a way to earn money. And this is what makes possible enormous specialization. It's what makes possible the division of labor being carried to the point where it is today. Each of us is in a position to live by doing virtually anything that some number of other people are willing and able to pay money for. We can specialize in anything that any other people are prepared to pay money for. Because then, once we have the money, we can easily turn around and obtain whatever it is that we want from other people, from third parties. Now try to imagine that money did not exist. here you are, you've been growing, going into your grocery store, whatever, buying clothing, paying your monthly mortgage payment. How many of you are doing a kind of work that your grocer needs, or needs very often and reliably? How many of you are doing any kind of work that your mortgage lender needs, or needs very often? I doubt that that's a significant element. Just think, how many of you are engaged in activities that, how many of you are engaged in producing for international trade, for goods that are going outside the state, or outside Orange County, or outside the particular part of Orange County that you live in? I think virtually all of us is engaged in producing for people who do not supply us. And each of us is supplied almost entirely by people for whom we do not produce. And if it ever became necessary that in order to be supplied, we had to produce something that the suppliers wanted, well, that would pretty much destroy the division of labor society. I just think if in order to obtain food, you had to produce what farmers wanted, well, what range of opportunities would be open to you? How could you live if money were destroyed and we were back to the days of the exchange of goods for goods, barter, the direct exchange of goods for goods? Well, either you'd have to go back and live as a farmer to have food, or produce the limited range of things that farmers frequently want. So maybe you could get by as a blacksmith, maybe you could get by as some kind of veterinarian, but there wouldn't be too many other opportunities. And in the absence of money, the division of labor would be pretty much wiped out. Yes, Mr. Whitechurch.
I have a question about that. I have I've got a friend who's a dentist, and I also have a friend who's a lawyer. Sometimes they create services right here in the United States. Yeah. But then, also with the fall of the economy in Argentina, under Xi here, I read about this, that there was these, I don't know what you want to call them, these bartering clubs. They didn't ever barter your goods or services because, they were so, the inflation was through the roof, so they couldn't depend on any currency. It was almost worthless, so they just decided to barter their goods for services in these bartering clubs. And there were more bartering clubs, per capita, since, the 1300s or, whatever it was,
You know, what they actually do, which really bails them out, is that they use a foreign currency, above all dollars. And if the Argentine government didn't forcibly oppose it, the money of Argentina would probably be dollars. I think Ecuador uses dollars as their money, and you would say also Panama.
Right.
There will probably be many of the smaller countries around the world that, if the development were not actively opposed, would be using dollars as their money, because their own monies are very, very poor. Now, when they destroy their local money, so long as there is an alternative like dollars to turn to, that even plays a role in whatever barter exchanges they may have, because how would they know how many loaves of bread to exchange for a television set or whatever? I think you could be sure they're consulting the prices of these things outside the country in the world market. If you had to literally have a physical exchange process, well, think how time-consuming and costly it would be. How could a firm pay its workers? Let's say you're producing ball bearings. Now, could you pay the workers the ball bearings and say, okay, now you guys go and barter the ball bearings, you get some bread and you get some milk and whatever? I think that would be a practical impossibility. So if you really do destroy money and there is no substitute money that can quickly take its place, that's destroying the economic system. And that plays a major role in explaining the collapse of ancient civilization. the Roman Empire in the 1st and 2nd century A.D. had a considerable degree of division of labor, the greatest up to that time, and it probably wasn't surpassed perhaps until the 15th century in modern times. And that was followed by centuries of self-sufficient production, that was feudalism. And what played a major role in that was in the 3rd century A.D., the Roman government, through a century-long policy of inflation, constantly expanding the money supply. They were collecting gold and silver coins and taxes, repeatedly melting them down, adulterating them with lead and copper to have more coins to spend. By the end of the century, the coins had virtually no precious metal content, and the Roman government wouldn't accept its own coinage in the payment of taxes. And that's when people had to start paying sheep and goats and all right. And at the same time, they prohibited the development of a new precious metal money because they were seizing any private gold or silver holdings. And so they destroyed money in the Western Roman Empire. That caused them to revert to feudalism. It prevented them from having a paid professional army. They were overrun by the barbarian tribes. So the destruction of money destroyed their economy. Someone here,
Mr. Richards, yes.
Could it be advantageous to us as a country that had other countries in the world lost the dollar as their currency, or disadvantageous?
Would it be advantageous or disadvantageous for other countries in the world to adopt the dollar as a currency? Now, to some extent, well, there are hardly any countries that actually use the dollar as their formal total currency. The dollar is demanded pretty much throughout the world to provide a kind of cash reserve. In most places of the world, you really wouldn't want to count on a local currency at all. And so I doubt that anyone would be stashing away Polish zlotys. I think that's their monetary unit, or many of the other currencies. And so people do have holdings of dollars. And it's estimated that perhaps half of the paper currency outstanding from the Federal Reserve is actually held outside the United States in the form of the 50s and $100 bills. Now, is that advantageous or disadvantageous? There's one sense in which it's advantageous. Every year, our government issues new and additional dollars. Some portion of these new and additional dollars goes outside the country and brings in goods and services in exchange. And so, to that extent, the United States is in the position of manufacturing paper money at hardly any cost. I just think, what does it cost to print a $100 bill on a volume basis? Probably less than a penny. So it's costing the United States Treasury pennies in effect, and American citizens are getting several billion dollars worth of goods each year. Now, ironically, this is presented in the press without realizing what's actually involved as an object of complaint. This comes under the heading of the unfavorable balance of payments. See, to this extent, to the extent the dollar is used globally as a cash reserve, and there's more dollars being created each year, then some part of the new and additional dollars leaves the country in exchange for goods, and we don't get those dollars back in exchange for exports. And a lot of people complain, well, we're importing more than we're exporting. To the extent that paper dollars are created and leave the country, we're importing goods, and we have that much less paper. Now, I don't see how this is really a disadvantage. Where it could be a disadvantage at some later point in time, if the policy of the United States government ever gets to be perceived negatively, so that people don't want to hold dollars abroad, and they decide they want something else rather than dollars, then what will happen to those dollars? They'll come rushing back to the United States, there'll be a vast flood of new and of additional money that will have to circulate in the United States. And what do you think that would do to its buying power? It would greatly reduce it. The export of the dollar helps to restrain the effects of domestic inflation. Is that Ms. Ferreira? Okay.
What about people that work here in the United States and earn money but send money to another country to support family elsewhere? How does that affect our economy?
Well, how does that affect our economy? I would think to a large extent, the people in the other country or the people that they buy from, they then buy goods from the United States in one way or another. Or to some extent, as I just explained, maybe some of that money will reside in the foreign country. I'm sure there are many people of Mexican origin who are remitting money to relatives in Mexico, and some of that money undoubtedly accumulates as additional cash holdings of Mexicans. And to that extent, there are goods and services that have been obtained, and we have paid for them, in effect, just by the creation of money at the cost of pennies. Yes, sir.
So would that be advantageous for countries like Mexico, who can buy gold from the U.S. and Mexico?
Well, the advantage to them is by people sending remittances, the relatives who receive remittances are able to buy things they otherwise couldn't have bought. That's the advantage to the recipients of the remittances. The main advantage to people in the United States is, the advantage to an individual is you're getting some good or service from someone of Mexican origin, and they're happy to perform it because you're paying them dollars.
Because when I went to Mexico, I was surprised that they're able to take my
Well, you see, the Mexican money doesn't have a very good record or very good prospects. Not too many years ago, there was a major depreciation. I forget what the older peso went from back, I guess it was in the late 90s, if I'm not mistaken. Suddenly its value plunged overnight, and whoever was counting on these pesos suddenly woke up and found they had lost a substantial percentage. And so people don't want to hold pesos knowing that that is something that can be repeated. So they'd rather hold dollars. Yes, that's the right. And
I have changed this back to the with the movement of a single type of money in Germany,
which
is using the advent more and more stimulus money being either yourself or your credit card as well as a check as much as change of cash. Do you see in the future the possibility of a single currency for the level of the first world countries or the industrialized countries? A single currency that would be able to totally offset other than the credit of that time.
I think you're asking really two questions. One is the question about a single currency, and the other is a paperless currency. Okay, now it's possible that we could have a paperless currency. I don't think we'll see it anytime soon because they're small transactions. Now, we do a lot of, most of the spending is in the form of checks or electronic transfers. So to that extent, it's paperless. I don't think that's a very critical issue. The key thing is there's some limited amount. It has to be certain assets in connection with it. But the other point is, can there be a single currency? There could be a single currency, but in fact, at one time, surprisingly in the past, there was essentially a single currency, or two currencies, the precious metals, gold and silver. If all of the individual countries were on the gold standard, then the separate monetary units would just be different denominations of the same money. And at one time, until the early 1930s, the dollar was defined as approximately 1/20th of an ounce of gold. The British pound was defined as approximately 1/4th of an ounce of gold, which meant that it would be approximately $5 equal to 1 pound. And the dollar and the pound, so long as both currencies were gold currencies, they represented essentially one currency. And most of the world was on the gold standard prior to certainly World War I. Now, you have a universal money that again, all of the different countries or major groupings adopted the gold standard. It's conceivable there could be a paper or quote paperless paper money, meaning non-precious metal, a global such money. It's conceivable, but I doubt very much that it could last. And I have doubts about whether the euro can last either, because there's an essential question that comes up, and that is, which of the different countries will get how much of the newly issued money? And will they all be content to agree to the same rate of increase in the quantity of money? And just think, look at things from recent history. If you're comparing the Dutch and the Germans on the one side and the Italians and the Spaniards on the other, do you think they had the same ideas about what is the appropriate rate of increase in the quantity of money in their country? Who do you think would favor what kind of policy? Do you have any information on this?
I would want your country to be
a great advantage. Well, there is a advantage, but I'm asking now about the rate of increase in the quantity of money. How would they perceive the advantage of their country? Like how would the Dutch and the Germans view what will be best for their countries? Would they think that the rate of increase in marks and Dutch guilders as rapid as the increase in lira and pesetas would benefit their countries? Would the Spaniards and Italians think a rate of increase in lira and pesetas as modest as the rate of increase in marks and guilders would be a good idea for their countries?
Well, if it's stolen out of their country, it wouldn't be to the benefit, but if it's staying in their country, it would be to the detriment, right?
Well, which would this assume it stays in the country? And what is your name, sir?
Keith Wilson.
Which do you think they would perceive as being beneficial? Rapid rate of increase, a la Spain and Italy, comparatively rapid, or comparatively slow, a la Germany and Holland? Ms. Novacki?
Yes, ma'am.
Nicolò Bessi.
Well, it depends on the economic standards in the country. For example, in Bulgaria, we are called the euro because it's so-called third world country. So to us, it would be much more beneficial to get the euro because they raise the standards of living and living in Bulgaria.
Okay. And many individual people in Bulgaria welcome the euro in the same way that people in Panama and Ecuador and Argentina welcome dollars. But the question is, if you look at the politics of Bulgaria, do you think the Bulgarian politicians and the pressure groups there are all content to have the quantity of money in Bulgaria increase no more rapidly than the supply of euros, or would they rather be able to have a more rapid increase in the quantity of money?
Maybe one just to slow
down. Or control it to make it slower or faster?
Faster.
I think faster. Do you think that the Italians and Spaniards will be content if the monetary policy of the European Central Bank is governed by the Dutch and the Germans? I don't think so. They'll think that's too slow a rate of growth. On the other hand, would the Germans and the Dutch be happy with a monetary policy geared to the, what we assume is the wishes of the Italians and Spaniards. I don't think they could be happy. Now, so it's difficult to see how the different countries can be satisfied for very long. They have different ideas about what's an appropriate policy. Like here in the United States, we have just been emerging from a fairly significant recession, and isn't there disagreement about what the Federal Reserve and the government should be doing to counteract the recession, prevent it from deepening? Is there agreement that what's being done is the only appropriate thing, or that other people would like to do something different? Aren't there some people connected with the bond market particularly who are concerned that we've had too loose a monetary policy? And there are others who are concerned with slow job growth who've been saying how the monetary policy has not been loose enough and there should be more rapid expansion. Right, so there's disagreement here, there's political disagreement. Now imagine that the disagreement becomes connected with a divergence of nationalities. So one policy is identified more heavily with one or a few nationalities, the other policy with other nationalities. Now just think, what can the implications of that be? There are people who are angry about what they perceive as a wrong economic policy. Now Kerry is blaming Bush, and Bush will be blaming Clinton, and arguing Kerry may make it worse or whatever. But suppose on top of that were added a nationality factor, so that a political party would be saying, well, it's these damn Germans who are responsible for the economic problems of Italy. And in Germany they'd be saying it's these damned Italians who are responsible for our economic problems. I don't see how that can easily be overcome. And if it isn't, it's hard to see how one can look forward to the Euro and the European Union enduring. Now, I don't think we hear too much talk along those lines right now, but I think this is a long-run consideration. Mr. Sweeney.
How would they convert that to the end of the
world? Well, things have reintroduced their traditional currencies. And in many of the areas, you know, the euro does not yet circulate throughout. The newer member states like Hungary, Bulgaria, the Czech Republic, they're not actually using the euro yet. I learned that the hard way when I made a trip last summer as a tourist. I flew into Budapest with what I thought was enough euros to pay for a cab or whatever. And then I learned that they're still taking the Hungarian florin. So they're not scheduled to actually use the euro for several years. The British aren't using the euro, and I would imagine that it wouldn't be so difficult to reintroduce the mark in Germany. They would probably introduce it one mark equals so many euros or a fraction of a euro. It would probably be easier than having introduced the euro. Yes, sir. Ms. Nicola.
Well, that's the original question was, the euro has been very strong and higher than the dollar, but the dollar is being used primarily to trade around the world. So how come the euro is going stronger than the dollar?
Why has it gotten stronger than the dollar? I would say it's the very, very low interest rate policy of the Federal Reserve. See, when the euro was originally introduced, I believe in 1999, if I'm not mistaken, it started out as equal to $1.17. And then within the next year or two, it quickly fell to 84 cents. And now, since that time, it's recovered, I think, to $1.27 or something. Or
$1.50.
How much?
$1.50.
$1.50? I don't think it's been that much. $1.27, I think, has been the peak. Maybe at some crooked retail exchange, especially in Prague, you might end up paying something like that. But I think the regular wholesale rate hasn't gotten above $1.27, $1.28. And what's responsible is interest rates, short-term interest rates in the Eurozone are significantly higher than in the United States. So that means people who want to invest money short term, there are more of them likely to buy euros rather than dollars. And money that would have been deposited in the U.S. at a higher rate is instead put over in a euro investment. If our interest rates go up relative to the euro interest rates, the dollar will improve relative to the euro. Yes, Jane.
What I understand is that I saw reading a book where she gave a book and write a book. Not only that, there's a book that really keeps playing a role.
Does political instability, does political stability or instability play a role in the value of the currency?
Yeah,
yeah, very, very definitely. If the more the political instability, the greater is the likelihood that the governments of such a country will resort to a policy of more rapid increase in the quantity of money in order to pay their bills. So if there's political instability, are people going to be eager to invest in such a country? I mean, after all, what does political instability mean in the last analysis? How does it affect individual investment decisions? Suppose you thought the governance of some country is unstable. What would that mean? Okay, what could happen if the government is unstable? Well, if it's seriously unstable, maybe have a revolution there, maybe some crackpot political party takes over, or a coup, and you don't know what they would do. What does that do to the security of property and the value of contracts in such a country? It makes the risk much greater. So would you want to have investments in such a country?
No.
You prefer not to. So people won't be buying that money for investment purposes. They may be attempting to liquidate investments they have there, buy other monies. So that will make that money depreciate. And then the tax revenues of such a country will diminish. The government will still have the same expenses, or still greater expenses. And Hal may very well find the money to pay for those expenses. Manufacture more of it, and well, that depreciates the money. So political instability weakens the money unless it creates doubt about the value of investments, the security of property, and the quantity of special money. Yes, Mr.
Davis. That was a good example. That was just a couple years back in Baja California, Mexico, and locally, where the government took over all of the American land properties. And so what we have now is there's this missing vacation here. There's all these half-built condominium complexes and all these structures that are halfway built. And you're like, why is he throwing our money in that? Because it's all the American money. That was going to continue to put money into something that the government owns.
You're saying that the people who were retiring there, and then they woke up to find that I think some group of Mexican Indians claimed ownership of the land, and the Mexican government side of that.
Yeah.
Okay, so there was a major upheaval in that part of their territory concerning who owned the land. And now, if you're going to invest in a country, you want to be very sure who owns the land. That has to be something which is beyond doubt. And so if you have a country that doesn't have secure title of land, well, that by itself, again, badly sabotages investment. So if everything has to be located on land, and the structures are not separable from the land, really, so if that comes into doubt, you don't want to invest there. So I say that, in addition to other things, would make the Mexican money less valuable. And throughout the world, there isn't all that much security of property. See, the United States is pretty distinct. The United States and other countries that have a heritage of Anglo-Saxon law, these are the countries with the greatest security of property. And that makes them the best places in which to invest. And this is the leading reason why people around the world are comfortable investing in the United States more, perhaps, than anywhere else. Because here, at least up to now, property rights have been fairly secure. You haven't had to worry about arbitrary convulsions giving major chunks of land back to different groups. Yes, Mr. Muraski.
Yeah, I'm just going back to get the production of money. The money was for developers. In this case, every ounce of gold that the government had, they printed a dollar for however, but wasn't a $35 per ounce of gold for years and years until 1955? Is that correct?
Yeah, actually, from 1968, we're going to go into that in some detail. If not tonight, certainly next week, but I hope tonight.
But now, when they first originally did that, that probably determined what they were going to, how much money they were going to produce. Is that correct?
Well, you see, under a gold standard, what determines the quantity of money is the amount of gold. What determines the rate of increase in the quantity of money is the state of gold money. For the gold standard, the money supply increases only to the extent that new and additional gold is dug out of the earth and exceeds the quantity demanded for jewelry and other industrial purposes. And this is a very major factor, as I hope we'll get to see very, very soon. So,
another part of the question. Yeah. How does the government determine how much money it's going to print a year? Is that based on the economy? I mean, how much money our country is actually making?
What determines the rate at which the quantity of money is increased when it has no connection to gold?
Yeah.
Okay, that's a very, very good question. And the answer is, there is no fixed principle of any kind. One prominent economist is now over 90 years old, Milton Friedman. He urged for many, many years that the government adopt some kind of monetary rule. And that would be increase the quantity of money by some defined percentage year in and year out, not more, not less, come hell or high water. He had some changes in the percentage as high as 5%, as low as 2%. Different times he indicated different figures. But no government has adopted that. And you can be sure if they did adopt it, they wouldn't hold it. Just like we had legislation on the books that the budget deficit was supposed to be eliminated, that lasted how long? About a year or so. There's nothing to bind the government to that. So, what's determining the rate of increase in the quantity of money is considerations of political expediency. Like, here we are, there's concern, we're threatened with a recession, and so the Federal Reserve goes full blast to lean against that. Reduces short-term interest rates all the way down to 1%. And is attempting to manufacture enough additional money to keep rates down at that low level. And other people are claiming, well, that's not enough. They should be doing even more. Have more tax cuts while the government continues to spend the same, and then the deficit can be financed to a considerable degree by the manufacture of additional money by the Federal Reserve. Now, how much is enough? How much is too much? These are subject of argument. And then there can be unexpected demands on the government's budget. There's a war on terror. That takes a lot of money. The war in Iraq takes money. Who knows what other things can come up? And then there'll be needs for additional billions. Now we have the prescription drug benefit that's just being phased in. That will require many billions. And the politicians don't want to raise taxes to cover these expenditures. So what is a likely source of the funds? Create more money. And creating more money is seen as the solution for almost every problem. So the one thing you can say with confidence is that the value of any of these irredeemable paper monies is certainly going to decline over the years. The only question is how rapidly. And I know this is a very personal concern to me, as I'm close to the age of retiring, and I know that if I put my money into fixed income securities, which can guarantee me a certain annual monetary income, I know that with each passing year, the buying power of the dollar is going to be less, and I will not have more income, so I'll have permanently declining income, and who knows where prices will be 25 years from now, at which point I'm still hoping to be alive. And I know that in the last 25 years, prices have certainly increased pretty dramatically. And should I count on them increasing only to the same extent, or might they increase twice as fast, or five times as fast? Nobody can know. So there's a tremendous uncertainty concerning anything denominated in a fixed number of dollars, and dollars are perhaps the best paper money of any. And this applies to contracts of any kind. Suppose you own a building or a piece of land, and you enter into a long-term lease contract. And so you'd agree that every year so many thousands of dollars or whatever will be paid to you. Well, if this is a long-term lease, who knows what that money is going to be worth later on in the lease. So it's really a kind of financial quicksand. Yes, Mr. Taylor.
So this is the following.
Yeah.
So I understand how we try to serve the economy, lowering interest rates, so therefore create more spending, But on the fundamental part around increasing money that I still don't get, maybe you might have again kind of questions on the cut
stuff,
is actually what happens. If there's no policy around how much money to spend, how does that actually work? Is there someone that Alan Greenspan simply say, we're going to print X number of dollars this year? Is that actually how it happens? Do we print that? Is there a monitoring process that says, this is how much money we destroy each year? Because it seems that at the end of the day, if I get this right, the amount of money that's out there, the more money that's out there, is deflated for value. So what's the management process?
How do they determine how much to increase the quantity of money?
Yeah, what's the actual process? I heard you say there is no rule.
Yeah.
So one, how do they determine? Okay, yeah, we're about to print, you know, 1 billion more, and then what actually happens? And then do you have any answer on that?
Well,
Do you know how much money has been printed this year? Do you know if they come out with the new quarters or the pennies, the new dollars now?
Yeah. There are somewhat reasonable statistics on the money supply. And in fact, I put them on the website. I got these figures right before the term started. There's a two-week lag. The money supply measured one way, according to M1, which is currency outside the banking system, currency in circulation outside the banking system, plus checking deposits, conventional type checking deposits. That, as of the week ended August 16th, was $1,337,000,000,000. Now that is probably that's too small a measure of the money supply. At one time, it would have been an adequate measure, but since around 1994 or 95, there's been some significant changes in the makeup of the money supply, and so the conventional M1 measure of currency out in circulation and conventional checking deposits, that's really inadequate. And there's one or more additional components that need to be added. And so here we have M1 traditional, year by year. We get to the most recent, 1337. Then there's another column here, cumulative sweeps. And there's a little article kind of attached to this that explains just what sweeps are, and they came into existence in 1994, and today I'd estimate it as representing practically 620 billion more. So if we add back to the 1337, the money supply would be practically 1957. And what these sweeps are is banks at which there are checking deposits, starting in 1994, began to make arrangements with large depositors so that on weekends and holidays, they could shift money from the checking accounts of these large depositors into something that would be classified as a savings account of one form or another. So during regular business days, the money you have is in a checking account among many of these large depositors. But on weekends, when the money isn't accessible anyway, and on holidays when it's not accessible, banks say they put it in something classified as a savings account. Now, why should they want to do that? Well, the banks are required by the Federal Reserve to hold reserves against conventional checking deposits. Typically, the reserve requirement is on the order of 10%. You can make as a rough principle that whatever conventional checking deposits are held with a bank, that bank needs to have a reserve equal to 10% of the checking deposits. And where do they have the reserve? Well, they can have it in part or even in whole in the form of their own checking deposit with the Federal Reserve Bank of their region. So imagine, for the sake of illustration, Bank of America has $10 billion in deposits, checking deposits. Well, Bank of America would be required, roughly, to have a reserve of $1 billion, roughly 10%. And where would this be? Well, it would be in the form largely of checking deposits held by Bank of America with the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco as the regional Federal Reserve Bank. And for the rest, Bank of America's reserve would be in the form of vault cash, currency within its own system, literally money in their own vaults. The two components, vault cash and deposit with the Federal Reserve, combined have to add up to the required reserve, which we're assuming as 10%. Now, Bank of America can't lend its required reserves, and that means they can't earn any interest on the required reserves. So that's a dead asset for them. They would much prefer to lend out some of those required reserves. And starting in 1994, the Federal Reserve allowed them to start to do so, because in transferring money from checking deposits to something classified over the weekends as a savings deposit, that served to reduce the required reserves. See, if something is not counted as a checking deposit, well, then you don't have to have 10% against it. There's no reserve requirement against savings deposits, or a much, much lesser one. So this meant that the banks could reduce their required reserves. They have the same volume of deposits, but have less required reserves, which permitted them to expand their loans and earn interest on a greater volume of outstanding loans. And then, of course, as they made these additional loans, this entailed the creation of new and additional deposits. So what happened was the volume of deposits ended up being larger. The same volume of reserves ended up supporting a larger volume of deposits. And these sweeps represent how much more the conventional money supply would have increased had this had these sweeps been counted that way. Yes.
The benefits of the depository taking savings, the savings amount of money for a 2-year period. What benefit is gained by them for interest on that? And how do they know if they know it's only available for 2 days, not going to be able to loan for 2 days?
No, the loan would not be for 2 days, but you see, they have required reserves based on an average. That makes the average of a week period or a 2-week period. So if they can reduce their required reserves 2 days out of the week, that's reducing the required reserves 28%. And then they have this much money available on a longer term basis. So they can make loans of a longer term nature.
Professor, my apologies.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Which one component was, when do we actually, then how do we actually, the Federal Reserve actually make the decision to print more money?
When do they make the decision to print more money?
And how
do they at present, I don't think they're deciding, even viewing it as a decision over how much money to print. In recent years, there's gotten to be some confusion over just what is the money supply. There's this issue of the sweeps, then there are further factors, retail money market accounts. So there are some people who say the Federal Reserve can't even know for sure what the money supply is at the moment, and there are different ways of computing it. And so what they have been going by is an interest rate policy. And when they reduce the federal funds rate, which is the one that you hear about when the Federal Reserve raises rates or lowers rates, in the last few meetings, I think they had two raises or something. It was down to 1% earlier this year. Then they had two meetings since the beginning of the year at which they had quarter-point increases in the federal funds rate. And in previous few years, the federal funds rate was reduced several full percentage points over since the year 2000, I believe. Now, the federal funds rate is the rate that banks pay in borrowing reserves from one another. See, the different banks have required reserves. And the banks are monitoring their reserve position. They know from day to day pretty much what their deposits are. They can calculate what their reserve requirements are. And they know if the reserves that they have are greater than what they're required to have or less than what they're required to have. And banks facing a reserve deficiency are interested in borrowing additional reserves. They don't want to go to the Federal Reserve itself unless they have to. They'd rather obtain needed reserves from other banks. And banks that have excess reserves, they're willing to lend the reserves. And there's a market, an interbank market, in these funds that qualify as reserves, and this is called the federal funds market, And the rate of interest on these interbank funds, the federal funds, is called the federal funds rate. And this is published, I think, in some places daily. I would expect the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times to have it daily here. Key rates. This appears every day in the business section of the New York Times. So as yesterday, the day before, and a year ago at the same time. And it's got the federal funds rate. A year ago, it was 1.04. Yesterday, sometime at the end of August, it was 1.5%. That reflects two increases. Now, the Federal Reserve announces a target for the federal funds rate. And how do they achieve this target? Well, they're watching what is the rate on federal funds in the federal funds market. And if it's getting above their target, I think it was 1.04 a year ago, they had a target of 1. Well, how would they nudge it down from 1.04 to 1? Or how would they nudge it down from 1.55 to 1.5? I'm assuming you guys in the back can see this. Am I wrong? Okay. Well, the Federal Reserve is in a position at any given time to increase or decrease the supply of federal funds. They can increase the funds that qualify as reserves or decrease them. How do they do this? Well, the leading way is by means of what is called the open market operation. The open market operation. The Federal Reserve, above all, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, on any given day, can be buying or selling securities in the open market. Almost always, they can find themselves the government securities. So they could be buying United States Treasury bills or other Treasury securities, 10-year notes or whatever, or sometimes they might sell them. Now, when the Federal Reserve buys government securities, what is it paying for them with?
Market value.
Pardon me?
Market value.
Well, the market value, but where does it get the money? Suppose the Federal Reserve Bank of New York will place an order to buy $1 billion worth of United States Treasury, short-term Treasury securities. T-bills. Pardon me? Somebody said print it? That's essentially what they do. They print the money. Now, it's not literally a process of running the paper through presses, and this relates to the paperless issue. The Federal Reserve can create money by a computer entry. They can create a credit to a checking account. They manufacture a cashier's check. Let's look at the process. Suppose the Federal Reserve places an order for $1 billion worth of Treasury securities, and it's from some bond dealer or securities dealer, and that dealer has had to obtain the securities from private individuals, private firms. And now the Federal Reserve Bank of New York perhaps will issue a cashier's check, or maybe the dealer has an account with the Federal Reserve. I don't know the precise mechanism. But let's assume he doesn't have his own account with the Federal Reserve. I think that's limited to government institutions and foreign governments. So let's say the Federal Reserve Bank of New York issues a cashier's check to Solomon Brothers or whatever, assuming they're one of the dealers. Well, what will Solomon Brothers do? And it, of course, will turn over the Treasury securities to the Federal Reserve. They then become one of the Fed's assets. What will Solomon Brothers do with his check, cashier's check, issued by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York? They will deposit it in their checking account, maybe their banker. I don't know who their banker is, but let's assume it's Citibank in New York. That would be a likely candidate. So now Citibank has the $1 billion cashier's check from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. It will credit the account of Solomon Brothers, so their checking account is plus $1 billion. And Citibank has this cashier's check. They'll present it to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Their checking account with the Federal Reserve Bank of New York will now be plus $1 billion. So there's an additional $1 billion of reserves possessed by Citibank. Now, what does this do? The Citibank's reserve position. It increases. If they had a deficiency before, they almost certainly don't now. And so Citibank will have additional, will have excess reserves. How will this affect the federal funds rate? They should lower it. Now imagine the Federal Reserve buying government securities. There'll be cashier's checks going to a variety of banks around the country, perhaps just major banks, but their excess reserves will be increased. They'll have more money available to offer in the federal funds market, and so how will that affect the federal funds interest rate? It'll go down, and so the Federal Reserve sees, okay, now we've brought the federal funds rate down to where we want it, and the process of doing so rests on the creation of new and additional money that qualifies as reserves. And now that the banks have these additional reserves, they'll have more excess reserves, what does that enable the banks to do in the way of their own lending operations? They can lend more, and in the process, that will entail deposit creation, which represents an expansion in the quantity of money. Yes, Mr. Rosenthal. Yes. Yeah, the essence of it is, I think, in chapter 12. Yeah. Are we?
The reading that you have in the website, you show them the creation of the book of the paper. In short.
No, but in the text. In chapter 12. In the supplementary ones? Where is that? Oh, yes. Now, you're talking about the Dow Jones book. The Sweets program. The Sweets program, I don't think that goes into the federal funds rate, does it?
No.
No. Okay. Yes.
Talk a lot about the value of loans, your precious metals, monetary system.
No.
Is that feasible today? Is there enough gold to do that? To be able
to is there enough gold to have a precious metal system? Well, that depends on what the value of a unit of gold would be.
What,
$400 an ounce, or anything close to $400 an ounce, I don't think would be sufficient. You'd have to have a value of gold probably on the order of $2,000 to $3,000 an ounce, if not more. But you see, if you had it, whatever the physical supply of gold is, it could be made equal to whatever the supply of dollars is. There is always some number that would equate the number of gold ounces with the number of dollars outstanding. If you took we have to do this on a global basis if you want to think of it that way. If the world money supply was $5 trillion, and if the supply of monetary gold in the world, if that were 4 billion ounces, well then I believe 4 billion ounces would equate to $5 trillion at $1,250 an ounce.
Is that a realistic option
here? It's a realistic option. I don't think that this could be achieved overnight dramatically, but there are, I think, if not opposed, the market would spontaneously move toward gold in the same way that people in Argentina and Panama would like to move toward dollars. I think similar considerations would move private citizens in the United States and the other advanced countries toward gold. And let me spend a little time on that. Believe it or not, I do have material on that in the syllabus, or in the syllabus supplement. Let me see if I can bring it up quickly. Pardon me?
Are you going
to
talk about the
gold in the Now, how is that? Well, let me see if I would get to this under the heading of the problem of inflation, how our whole problem of inflation understood is the aspect of constantly rising prices. Why are prices continually rising? There's more and more money being created, and just think how quickly are you able to create an irredeemable fiat money, irredeemable paper money, or the paperless paper money, the checkbook money, the electronic money. What are these physical difficulties in the way of increasing the quantity of that money? Do we have a shortage of paper or ink? And if we did, you could still add a zero to any whatever paper you have. Or electronically, you can create billions of dollars with a few keystrokes. So an essential characteristic of irredeemable fiat money is that there is no physical limit to its quantity, and it is virtually costless to produce. You have a money that has virtually no cost of production and no physical limitations to its quantity. Now, why then does it have any value at all? So you just think, in other cases, we have goods with a very minimal cost of production. What's the cost of production of paper clips, rubber bands, pins,
table salt?
What's the cost of production of these things? It's minimal, right? And what's the effect of that on their value, given that the production of these things can easily be increased? It's not that someone has a monopoly on the production of table salt. Anytime you have something with a minimal cost whose production can be expanded without any problem, what will be the effect on the value of such a treat? It has a very minimal value. Now, if you ask why should the value of paper dollars be any greater than the value of the paper clips? And how much more does it cost to produce this than a paper clip? Now, what do you think would happen if this sort of thing were produced under the freedom of competition? So here we are, we have something that has the buying power of a dollar, but if you can get the same color ink and have the same electronic. Now, so imagine, suppose there were no laws against counterfeiting. What do you think would it become worthless? In fact, it would have less value than paper clips and pins. You see, today, you go into a supermarket and have a wallet full of this currency, you come out with a shopping cart full of groceries. But if the day ever came when you had to go into the market with a shopping cart full of the paper money and come out with a wallet full of groceries, then the money would be dumped in the sewers. People wouldn't want it. But that's where its value would go under free competition. Now, why doesn't the value go there? Well, why doesn't the value go to nil today? But when we limit the supply, there are counterfeiting laws. The only party legally allowed to increase the quantity of money is the government. So that prevents the immediate destruction of the value of money. It doesn't evaporate overnight, because only the government is allowed to create it. It has a monopoly privilege on the creation of new and additional money. But even so, while the money doesn't collapse overnight, the government has enormous and irresistible temptations. Because here's the government, what is their cost of expanding the quantity of money? Virtually nothing. What are the demands made upon the government for additional money? Aren't there all kinds of groups with their hands out, give me money for this, this is an urgent need, how can you ignore these vital needs? And people are enumerating the needs and what would be the benefits of a program, and they don't feel any requirement of considering costs. Well, the government wants to be reelected, whoever is in power wants to be reelected, and what is always a method of gaining some significant constituency? To give them money. Now, on the other side, it's not very popular to raise taxes. So if the government is under pressure always to increase its spending, but doesn't want to raise taxes, and they have the power to create money, well, how much further do we need to look? The government has a constant temptation to expand the quantity of money, because it represents a kind of wish and illusion fulfillment. People think that they think of the government as the source of free benefits. Now, what allows them to think that? See, suppose the government could not create money. Imagine the government didn't have that power. And they wouldn't if the money were gold. See, gold is something the government hasn't figured out how to create. Alchemists have been at it, but they have never been able to succeed. So if the money was gold, the government could not create money. And what would that imply about any additional spending the government wanted to do? They couldn't do it. The only way to have the money would be from taxes or cutting other government expenditures, neither of which they want to do. Well, now, if the government couldn't create money, and people are clamoring for some new government program, and the only way the government can get the money for the program is by raising their taxes or cutting some other program, how likely of success would proposals for new government programs be? It would be very unlikely. Any time anyone proposed some new government program, immediately the question would be raised, where do you get the money? And in fact, show me the money, show me where you're getting the money. And the government would have to say, well, we're getting it from you. That wouldn't be very popular. Now, when the government has the ability to create money, there's an incredible disconnect. With the ability to create money, the government is really in a position to say, okay, we have our own source of money. We have money that we don't have to get from the citizens. Where can we get it? Well, we can manufacture the money. The government then has a source of funds that is independent of the citizenry. And this creates a tremendous reversal of the way people think of the relationship between the citizen and the government. See, if the government couldn't create money, where would it have to get all of its money? From the citizens. For a little while, they might borrow the money, but they couldn't do that for very long, because then their debt would be growing, the interest rates they pay would be rising, they'd end up in bankruptcy. Unless they're utterly reckless, they'd want to avoid that. If they want to avoid incurring debt, which they know is a destructive dead end, then they must have a balanced budget. They must always secure the funds to meet their expenditures in the current year to avoid the accumulation of debt. But that means all new spending is additional taxes, which makes the spending very unpopular. The citizens would know that they are the source of the government's money. They would not believe that the government can collectively give them anything. They would know that whatever the government is giving any one citizen, it is taking from another citizen. And so the people would see the government as financially dependent on them. Well, when the government doesn't have that constraint, when the government can manufacture its own money, then the people think they are dependent on the government. And the government, in effect, today stands outside the economic system. It has its own money. People think, well, here we are, we're in a recession, times are getting up. The government can spend billions or trillions, if necessary, from where? Well, it will manufacture money to whatever extent necessary. You see, people are looking to the government as supporting them, when in reality, ultimately, it's the people who have to support the government. But this permits a tremendous expansion in what the government does. You have a radically smaller government if people recognize that every dollar of additional government spending would be a dollar of additional taxes. Yes, Mr. Chung.
Traditionally, it's that the U.S. dollar is backed up by gold for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
And ever since, this is true, ever since the turn of the Second Life Watchful Era in the early 1990s, U.S. dollar that no longer backed by gold is backed by intellectual property. Now, is that the case?
Intellectual property?
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's what I heard. And so if that's the case, how could U.S. government got other countries bought into the concept of that U.S. dollar essentially is not, you know, no longer backed up by gold, because gold essentially is worthless. From $500-something an ounce down to $200 back in the early 1990s, and then the technology stopped, you know, evolutionized the entire economic system, if you will.
Well, you're saying technology, the dollar was back to gold. And you think that this ended when in the...
In the 1990s.
It ended a lot before that. there's one of the things I have planned here. Notice, so I'm devoting the theory to answering your questions, but in the process of doing so, I am covering material on this supplement. Notice, I have a point here, 4, under the heading, the origin and evolution of money and the contemporary monetary system. How did we get to the state of the money that we have today? When in the past, at one point, it was essentially gold money. Well, from the founding of the United States, dating from the Constitution, I should say, which I believe was enacted in 1788, in the Constitution, there is a statement, Congress shall have the power to coin money and regulate the value thereof. And from the enactment of the Constitution down to the Civil War, the Constitution was understood to prohibit the federal government from issuing anything but gold and silver coin as money. There was nothing in the Constitution that said the government should have the power to print money, it said to coin money. That was understood to be precious metal money. And so the only money issued by the federal government from 1788 to 1861 or 2 was gold or silver coin. And that money was literally bars of gold shaped as coins and stamps. Now, in this period, there also was privately issued paper money in the form of bank notes, currency, holding currency, and checking deposits. And this amounted to a significant part of the total money supply, but these are privately issued bank notes and checking deposits were all redeemable on demand in gold or silver. And so the banks were obligated to pay gold or silver. And the country was on a tight gold standard. And the value of the dollar was defined as approximately 1/20th of an ounce of gold of a definite fineness. Now, periodically, the paper portion, the claims to gold, the banknotes, and the checking deposits, again and again, they came to be overissued. They came to be issued in a quantity too great for the available quantity of gold behind them. And while the process of expansion was underway, there would be conditions of a boom, there would be no additional money, but again and again, it culminated in bankruptcies and the failure of banks. And when a bank would fail, the quantity of money would actually decline, result into a negative territory. Just imagine that you have a checking deposit at some bank, and you woke up one morning and you learn that your bank had failed, and no other bank took it over, and there was no Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Well, what do you think that would do to the quantity of money? To reduce it, you had a checking deposit. Now, the checking deposit was accepted as the equivalent of standard money, but now it has the status of a junk bond, and you can't use it to spend. Well, again and again, that happens. Now, so long as the banknotes, the currency, was privately issued by a multitude of separate banks, each one had its own currency with these different size, color, appearance. We've seen stock certificates of different companies. No two of them are very similar. Well, there was as much variation in the paper currencies of the different private banks. And there was tremendous risk with these different private banks. So unless you were pretty much of an expert, you would not want to accept the notes of a bank unless you could hightail it pretty quickly to the main office and cash it for gold or silver. So the ability of banknotes to circulate much beyond the offices that issued them was very limited. So what did people have to use as money to be sure of having the kind of money that would be accepted everywhere? Precious metals. Okay, so precious metal money played a major role in the daily life of the people down to the Civil War. Now, in the Civil War, both sides issued irredeemable paper money. The southern money became utterly worthless. The northern money, they issued greenbacks. The greenbacks were dollars, but you couldn't redeem them for gold. Later, you could, starting in 1879. But from the time the issue began, which I believe was in 1861 or in the early years of the Civil War, they were irredeemable. Now, this was not the most significant factor. What was more significant was that in the Civil War, in 1863, a bill was passed known as the National Bank Act, which began the national banking system. And you may notice that a bank will say, like we have in Chicago, there's First National Bank of Chicago. I think there's the First National Bank of Boston and Philadelphia. Other banks are national banks without that being prominent in their names. I think Chase Manhattan, Citibank, these are members of the national bank system. So this goes back to 1863. And what the National Bank Act did was it prohibited, in effect prohibited, the issue of private bank notes. It imposed, it said you could do it, but you had to pay a tax of 10% of the value of the bank notes. It took away all profit from the issue of these private bank notes. Instead, the members of the national bank system were empowered to issue national bank notes. These national bank notes all had a uniform size, color, and appearance. Only in the fine print would you see any distinction. In the fine print, it might say a national bank note issued by First National Bank of Boston rather than Chicago or wherever. But for all intents and purposes, we now had, for the very first time, a uniform national paper currency. These national bank notes. And there were fairly stringent requirements connected with their issuance. The banks that issued them had to have a gold reserve equal to 25% of the face value of the notes. So as the Bank of Podunk issued $1 million of national bank notes, it needed to have $250,000 in actual gold as part of its reserve. And on top of that, they needed to have United States government securities equal to a further 90% of the value of the notes. And these government securities, certainly starting after the Civil War, were all redeemable in gold. Let me say that the experience of the Civil War with the greenbacks and the inflation that that entails brought about a couple of generations where practically every contract needed to have a gold clause. People were burned very badly in the Civil War with depreciated paper dollars, and thereafter, down to 1933, they insisted on a gold clause, making debts payable in gold. So the federal debt that was payable in gold, principal and interest, practically all the corporate debt, the railroad bonds, mortgages for the most part, practically everything was payable on a gold basis. But the National Bank Act, with this tremendous gold cover for the national bank notes and their uniform size and appearance, this made it possible for the first time to have a national paper currency. And these notes came quickly to be accepted without question everywhere throughout the country. Well, what do you think this did to people's perceived need to have holdings of gold coins? It went down, and so if you look at the statistics, decade by decade, following the Civil War, there was a significant decline in the circulation of actual gold coin. And by the time of World War I, or even sooner, gold coin had practically ceased to circulate. It was legal. You could redeem paper money on demand for gold, and the banks had to give it to you. But outside of a few areas, maybe in Nevada or Montana, where they were still mining precious metals, gold coin did not circulate. Children might get a gold coin on their birthday or something, but it ceased to be mined. And so by the time of World War I, there had been a generation or more of people who had virtually no experience of the active use of gold. And then in 1913, the Federal Reserve System was established. And in 1917, I believe, there was a World War I amendment to the original Federal Reserve Act. And this required that the private banks, which had meanwhile gathered up practically the entire gold supply of the country, see, people who didn't feel the need to hold gold coin anymore, where did they put it? They put it in the bank, the smaller banks redeposited it with the bigger banks. And by 1917, practically the whole gold supply of the country was held by a small number of very large banks in New York City and to some extent in Chicago. And then this World War I amendment to the Federal Reserve Act required that these banks turn over their gold holdings to the Federal Reserve System. And in exchange, they got Federal Reserve notes and checking deposits with the Federal Reserve banks. So, something to keep in mind, the real major government control over the gold supply came about well before the New Deal. The New Deal came into office in 1933. But the major transfer of gold occurred as early as 1917 under this wartime amendment to the Federal Reserve Act. Now, in 1933, we had this during the depths of the worst depression in our history. This was the depression characterized by wave after wave of bank failures. And as the bank failures occurred, the quantity of money was reduced, which undercut the volume of spending, made it more difficult to repay debts, caused more bankruptcies and bank failures. So this is why the process was one of wave after wave. It was like a house of cards, tremendous issuance of claims to gold for which there was no gold, and one bank after another was going belly up. Now, when the New Deal took power, it wanted to end this process, and there was a banking holiday for several days. The banks were just closed. I guess something to compare to the closure of the stock market after 9/11. And when they reopened, they no longer had any obligation to pay gold. And in fact, an early New Deal measure was to compel the private citizens to hand in the remaining gold coin to the federal government at the rate of 20 paper dollars per ounce of gold. And so from that point on, there was virtually no lawful monetary gold in private hands. There was a couple of years of indeterminacy, but in 1935, the official exchange value of gold was raised from approximately $20 an ounce, where it had been since 1788, to $35 an ounce. But American citizens did not have any right to redeem their paper dollars for gold. The redemption at $35 an ounce was allowed only to foreign governments and foreign central banks, not to private citizens. In fact, there were severe legal penalties imposed on the private ownership of gold for monetary purposes, comparable, or maybe even worse, than those on the possession of some drugs today. If you were caught owning gold for monetary purposes, there could be a fine as high as $10,000 and a year in jail. And there was a 20% excise tax imposed on the use of gold in jewelry. Now, only gradually were these very draconic laws repealed, and it wasn't until 1975 that the free private ownership of gold was again fully recognized. But now, following 1935, the federal government attempted to maintain an international price of gold of $35 an ounce. And they were able to maintain that until as late as around 1968. Now, what happened was, in the late 30s, and then in World War II, we got most of the monetary gold that had previously been held in Western Europe. the European countries were buying military supplies, and to the extent they were buying from the United States, and they were expanding, inflating their own money more than we were inflating the dollar. They were running a negative balance of payments. The United States was collecting in more money than it owed, and we were getting the net balance largely in gold. So we had a huge gold stock by the end of World War II, much greater than we do today. Now, a treaty in World War II was known as the Bretton Woods Agreement, where while the United States would still have a currency tied significantly to gold, the dollar was defined at $35 an ounce, and most of the countries throughout the world would hold would define their currencies in terms of dollars. They attempt to have some kind of relationship to the dollar. And the idea was to attempt to make the world monetary system appear as though it's still closely tied to gold in some important way. And to maintain that belief, while American citizens couldn't legally own gold, there were places around the world where you could, such as people in Hong Kong, I think even in Canada, I'm sure various other countries, Switzerland certainly. And so there was a global demand for gold, and as the United States government was creating dollars more rapidly than the supply of gold was increasing, at some point it would become necessary for the dollar price of gold to rise. So just think, here we are, we're creating dollars. The additional dollars are serving to raise wages. They're raising the price of copper, lead, and zinc. They're raising the price of wheat, soybeans, orange juice, plywood, one thing after another, real estate. But here's gold. It's always saying it's $35 an ounce. Well, what do you think that does to the quantity of gold demanded simply for industrial purposes? It has to get greater. It's the substitution effect, as it were. Gold is unchanged. Everything it could be substituted for is rising. So the industrial demands for gold would have to be increasing. And after some years, people began to realize that sooner or later there would inevitably have to be a rise in the price of gold. And as they began to realize this, there came to be speculative runs on gold. And the government, I should have mentioned perhaps a moment earlier, starting in 1951, the London gold market reopened. It had been a market before World War II. It was closed during World War II and in the immediate post-war years. It reopened in 1951. And the United States government, in conjunction with the Bank of England, wanted to maintain a $35 price of gold on the London gold market. Now, most of the world's demand for gold would come into the London gold market. The newly mined and scrap gold would be offered for sale in the London gold market. And what do you think would happen if, at the $35 an ounce price, the quantity demanded exceeded the supply offered? If we did nothing, the price of gold would rise above $35. So that would create thoughts, well, the dollar isn't that firmly tied to gold. It's not as good as gold. If you want to promote the conviction the dollar is as good as gold, then you have to keep the price at $35. Well, what has to be done so that when the quantity demanded exceeds the supply available, the price will nevertheless stay at $35? Pardon me? Yeah, the U.S. government would feed additional gold from its reserves into the London gold market, sufficient to keep the price of gold at $35. Now, this went on from 1951 to 1965, and as time went on, there came to be more powerful speculative runs, so the gold stock of the United States government from year to year was significantly declining. And finally, by 1964 or 5, it was recognized that we couldn't keep this up much longer. And I should point out, in these years, from 35 to 65, there were still gold reserve requirements. The Federal Reserve was obligated itself to have a gold reserve of between 25 and 35% of its notes and checking deposit liabilities. 25% against the one and 35% against the other. I think that much. Either the currency or the checking deposits. Now, as the gold stock declined, the Federal Reserve's own required gold reserve was getting dangerously close to the reserves they actually had. Well, the reserves they actually had, I should say, were declining to the point where there was very little more than what they were legally required to have. So it wouldn't have been very long before the Federal Reserve would be confronted with a reserve deficiency. So what do you think was done to avoid that? Funny? Yeah, the reserve requirements were abolished in 1965. So since then, the Federal Reserve does not have any gold reserve. And at the time, there were some commentators who were happy and saying, well, this frees up all this gold to maintain the $35 an ounce price. We can now dump all this in the London gold market. Well, three more years went by. They finally gave it up, closed the so-called gold window, and then they were threatening to dump the remaining reserves to destroy the gold market. That made the market hesitate. But then it became clear this would not be done. And starting from around 1970, the price of gold began to shoot up. It reached a high of $850 an ounce in January of 1980. The government finally went way back on its rate of increase in the quantity of money, and the price of gold sharply declined. And now there are some renewed fears that the price of gold is back from a low of maybe 260 or so. Now it's been in the neighborhood of 400. Okay, I'm going to ask you to postpone the questions till after our return. We've already run a few minutes late, so let's wait till 10 after 8, okay?